listening to Dig Deep on Northern Community Radio. I'm Heidi Holton with Aaron Brown and Chuck Morrell. We continue the conversation on unions. The role of unions today, are they vital to our society? What do you think the role is, Chuck?
It's interesting because I first became aware that there was such a thing as a union outside of history class when I realized that my parents were in unions. My parents were elementary school teachers. They belonged to a teachers' union. That union collected dues from them and negotiated on their behalf. And it was really strange to me because I remember being in like my AP history class in high school and reading about Huey Long and like the early union movement and these people getting taken out and shot and killed and thrown in ditches and, you know, all the things that were done to kind of squash unions. And then look over at my parents, you know, who were
eating
leading
oatmeal.
At the time,
right,
like very nice lives and, you know, arguing over whether they were going to have donuts or coffee at the, you know, break in the morning. And I'm belittling it a little bit, but the contrast between the two seemed really stark to me. And I had a hard time grasping how these were both unions. You know, you're in a union today.
Yeah.
And so maybe, you know,
one of the things you have to think about is when we talk about the early union movement, like you said, the battles and things, and people were trying to escape just totally terrible conditions and achieve something, achieve essentially rights, human rights out of their employers. And of course, it's not like that now, not exactly. But what I think the union movement today would say is that our goal is to win a fair share of what's out there and protect our economic well-being the same way anybody else would. And that collective bargaining is a way to do that for everyone, protecting a larger group because a single person negotiating isn't as strong as everybody negotiating. And it's really a matter of fairness. As a teacher myself, and teachers' unions are a little different than other unions. As I mentioned, intellectual freedom and other things that are a little different than other unions are part of the discussion when we have our negotiations. But essentially, that's what it is. We're trying to protect the time and the profession. You know, it's a professional union. People have to be credentialed or trained in a certain way to get the job. And so we want to protect the investment that people made to become that job, to take on that position, and it's a position of trust with people in the public eye. So it's a matter of protection. It's a matter of fairness for pay for you know, working conditions. You know, what's professional for a teacher to encounter in their workday?
I think it's interesting because my background, I'm a civil engineer. And I did two summer internships with the State Department of Transportation. And I found out there, again, that they're unionized as well. It's very interesting because as a professional, as someone who, you know, has a college degree, has a license, it seemed very odd to me that I would, in a sense, want to be part of a collective as opposed to, you know, individually. And I think you can see a lot of engineers. I mean, I went into private practice. I think I could have gone to work at MnDOT. It really never was something I considered deeply after school because it wasn't, you know, I'm not maybe the stuff of a union in the sense that there is a certain amount of self-sacrifice you make. I look at a union, particularly in that sense, as taking kind of the highs and lows off and kind of moderating things a little bit. And it wasn't the right fit for me. But it seemed odd to me. And it still seems a little odd to me that, you know, a group of professionals would need, in a sense, to fight against the man. I mean, aren't you the man? I mean, they were largely management themselves. Mm-hmm. I step back and I look at it and I don't see my colleagues as engineers who work for the state to be, in a sense, replaceable cogs, people who could just be summarily, you know, chewed up and thrown out and replaced by someone else. And so the question I've got, and I think I'd ask Aaron this, what's the thing that public employees union or a white collar union is a counterweight to? In the early labor movement, the union was really the counterweight to capital. It was really the counterweight to the people that owned the machine that was chewing them up. Today, you know, I look at your union or my fellow colleagues as engineers union, And they're the counterweight to me, you know, the voter or the politician or, you know, the government in a sense, which I've always viewed as a collection of us. So how is that dynamic applicable today?
That's Chuck Marone from Strong Towns. We've been talking about unions on Dig Deep, the history of unions. Now we're considering what unions mean today. Chuck asks Aaron Brown, who's in a teachers union and writes the blog Minnesota Brown, who it is that they are negotiating against.
Well, the answer is the state or the county or whatever outfit is employing the people. And you say, well, that's a public entity, and therefore you're negotiating against the voters and their tax dollars. If you look at it this as, you know, who are you fighting? Then sure, that's probably why public sector unions are much less popular than private sector unions in the public's eye. What I would say about my union, for instance, and the contract that I work under, is that the state of Minnesota's contract for faculty for a community college is significantly better than most of the contracts or working conditions that any other person like me faces in other states. In fact, you go to conferences, it's almost like you don't want to go, because you get talking to people in, say, Arizona or in the South or Texas, and you realize you do the same job as them and you make literally twice as much money. And you probably have a much better protection against random and inexplicable layoff as they do. And the reason, though, is precisely because it's been a negotiated contract. And so teachers in Minnesota, for instance, are treated as professionals and have negotiated for protections to their work environment. And our argument is that that creates a better situation. You get better qualified people into the jobs and you create a better environment for students and for the customer, which is also the taxpayer in this instance. So you have to ask yourself whether the argument is, well, you can't negotiate against the state when you're a state employee. You know, it's true that they weren't unionized quite often in the past. And there was like this, it was the old argument that in the old days, a government job was not a well-paying job, but you got a good pension and it was a secure job because, you know, who else would want to be the file clerk down at City Hall? You know, it's just do your job and it would be fine. And of course, as we've entered this, well, maybe not the most partisan environment our country has faced, but a very visibly partisan environment. Things like at a college, if you're a biology teacher and you encounter political environment surrounding the teaching of evolution, or in economics, you know, where it's very easy to misinterpret teaching about Marxism versus being a Marxist in the eyes of students, in the eyes of parents, you find that, you know, this job where you're supposed to get a decent pension and not be much trouble to anybody, suddenly you're in the crossfire. And that's what's happened with a lot of public employees, is that they find increasingly they're in the crossfire of public debate. And the union offers a chance for them to kind of get together and protect their jobs, yes, but that's partly what unions do, but also the ability that they have to do their job the way they want to do it. You know, there's that stereotype of I got tenure, it doesn't matter what I do, I can do whatever I want. And I've met people like that, but they're so far in the minority of my colleagues. I can name names of colleagues who
they
are,
make a good bumper sticker for the disaffected, right?
Yeah. But I've got colleagues who don't even have to work. They could have retired and they're still working and they're still among the best people at the institution. And so there's a lot of stereotypes about things like tenure, about things like public service unions or public sector unions that makes it easy to attack in a political environment.
Here's what I wonder, and this is what I kind of struggle with. I realize we call these unions, and I realize that they're organized like mm-hmm. unions, and they come out of the union tradition, but are they really unions? Mm-hmm. I mean, we
were called an association for a long time. We weren't called the union until a few years ago they switched back to union, and frankly, I can only assume that it's because they wanted us to think like fighters instead of
They want you to have your pitchforks and
they wanted us
at
to know that this is a wartime environment and that we should be ready for it.
Well, you look, and I mean, I think we all understand that there should be what in the old days used to be called civil service protections. you don't want, and I'll use our current administration at the federal level as an example, regardless of whether you think the policy is right or not, when an incoming administration sends a memo to, say, the EPA and wants to know every person who's worked on climate change, for example, that's
a threatening environment.
Yeah, that's a threatening environment. Mm-hmm. And really, you know, I think what we want from our public officials, our public servants, is we want them to be free to act as professionals. We want to hear their professional opinion. We want their professional expertise. And more so than a blue-collar worker, which I want to get back to at some point here, but more so than a blue-collar worker, that has to provide you a certain level of latitude and free thinking that doesn't go well sometimes with representative democracy. When a news group comes in that doesn't like that latitude of thinking, okay, we're going to purge everybody who is there. And what you do is you get ineffective government. I think we're like in total agreement on that. Is that best done through a union? Is that best done through some type of civil service protection? And I think to me, the difference there gets to the struggle they had in Wisconsin that was so high profile a few years ago over collective bargaining. Do we as public employees, as white collar public employees, professionals, have the right to essentially stop work or walk out in order to get our way in a negotiating process? And I think that's a line that I'm uncomfortable with. I'm probably more sympathetic to what they did in Wisconsin than the average Minnesotan is. Hmm. But I see why that is a line that people argue over.
Yeah. There's all kinds of like strikes when you see strikes on city transit systems or janitorial strikes, and you have piles of garbage in the streets, and you say, well, what right do they have? And I think that comes back down to the fundamental of labor, which is the right is that the people who do the work have a value that they're trying to negotiate for. And if you don't pay people what they're worth, they can stop. People, you know, complain about what ball players make, or football players, or baseball players, and they say, "Why does so and so get $30 million a year to bounce a ball around and throw it in a hoop?" And the answer is simply because he can, because in the marketplace, that's what he's worth. And believe me, the owners make money too. Otherwise, they would never pay those salaries. So
I think, though, that the professional sports athletes unions are fascinating.
They're weird. Yeah.
Well, there's two primary distinctions between them and like a public service union. The first one is that they have set a mechanism in place where individuals can negotiate with management based on their own value. It would be as if like the best teacher at the school was able to negotiate a salary twice as high as anybody else because they added a lot of value.
Right.
We don't allow that to happen in a public employees union. The second thing is that sports unions tend to stick it to the new people coming in. In other words, we're going to have a system where, okay, only so much money is going to be distributed around. We're going to split revenues with management 50-50 is what they do in like basketball. Mm-hmm. Too much of that is going to rookies. And so in our next contract agreement, we'll agree that rookies' salaries are capped, mm-hmm. but people who have been here a long time, they're not capped.
That's not totally unusual. I mean, it's not to that degree, because the difference between a rookie making minimum and LeBron James is a rather large chasm.
But I would argue that the difference between like a really, really good teacher mm-hmm. and a teacher who's kind of mailing it in is a massive chasm too, particularly if you follow the argument we're often given by education people, which I buy, mm-hmm. which a teacher has a massive impact.
Chuck Marone from Strong Towns and Aaron Brown writing the blog Minnesota Brown. They've been comparing unions on this edition of Dig Deep. Contemporary unions like pro sports versus education. Aaron is an instructor at Hibbing Community College.
Speaking as a teacher, and I know, you know, you can try to put my colleagues on a spectrum of, you know, who's the lousiest in the building and who's the very best. And I can try to imagine, and is there a difference between a good teacher and a mediocre teacher? Yeah, I'd totally agree with that. What happens in the classroom is very important. But the problem is with education and with whether it's working in a plant, assessing the very best, and then creating a system of assessment is so dang hard. You know, because if you're teaching remedial English, you're churning out students who maybe hated English and now they hate it only a little bit. And that's a big win in some of those environments. And they're maybe not scoring super high, but their score improved dramatically versus somebody teaching the honors English or the higher level English classes who is able to inspire future writers to be the greatest writers ever, you know. And that's both are remarkable accomplishments in their own way. It's really hard to say who the LeBron James is and then punish somebody who's, you know, a second stringer. With football, basketball, sports, it's like, look at their statistics. They scored this many points. They have the sabermetrics people will tell you if they helped them win or not, if they helped the teams win or not. There's no mechanism for teachers like that. In fact, one of the things we talk about a lot at the college, at the community college level or in the public sector, we don't get to say who comes to school in a given year. We are charged with educating anybody who can come in and qualify for aid or pay the tuition, no matter what. And we have to do something to help them. And that's a difficult thing to assess. We try. It's part of what we do is assess our accomplishments. But in terms of determining who's worth more, it's really hard to do at the level that you see in public, in professional sports.
Right. I think you see that too at like MnDOT with engineers and public employees unions. I think it's interesting too, because you kind of drew a distinction between what I would call more blue collar public employees workers, mm-hmm. the bus drivers, the janitors, you know, the people picking up trash in some places, as opposed to, you know, the person sitting behind the desk with the degree. Mm-hmm. I do think that is, and that's what I kind of want to get into in the next segment too, is the future of unions and how the blue collar and the white collar, are those really, mm-hmm. can they be in the same union and actually look out for each other? Or do they really need two separate mm-hmm. kind of structures?
I just want to say one more thing about unions today as it is. One of the things you can look at is unions making progress for their members, protecting their own. But I think if you are, for instance, if you're not in a union, why should you ever support a union? One of the things that I would say is look at what union wages do to the economy compared to lower wages that almost universally go to people who are doing the same job who are not in unions. And
no, I hear you. And you're right in the sense that it drives up wages. I'm not sure, and I think this is, I'm not sure that is true beyond white collar workers. In other words, I think what you might be seeing is that it actually drives down wages of blue collar workers, particularly those outside of unions. There's no question that if you're in a union as a professional, you're going to, at the median, make a lot more than people are outside mm-hmm. of a union. And that does have an upward effect on salaries for white collar workers. I think for blue collar workers, though, what I would put forth is that I think it creates a huge split. You're either a winner where you get the government job and you're going to do well in the union, or you're not, in which case the wages are going to be way lower than they would normally be.
I don't know, though. I think if you look at manufacturing, I think there's a clear distinction between the level of pay for union workplaces and those who do not negotiate for a collective pay scale.
I think there's no doubt, but now you're talking about private unions. And I would draw a distinction between public and private unions in that regard.
Oh, so you okay, so we're talking about different things. But
Yeah.
Okay.
I think when you know, to me, one of the, you know, the argument you seemed to be making was unions bring up salaries across the board. Mm-hmm. And I think that is generally true, except for blue collar non-union labor.
So you're talking about like garbage truck drivers and bus drivers and that kind of thing.
Who are not in a union. I feel like that's the group. If I could magically like rearrange the union landscape, it would be those people who actually had union representation. Mm-hmm. And most of the people who have union representation today would not. In other words, I feel like they're the ones who are having their wages driven down by the union structure, not mm-hmm. the other way around.
I think a part of it is you trying to create a sense of humanity for workers who would otherwise, who would be called by some people replaceable. And I think that's what the goal is. You're trying to create a sense of humanity for the work that they do that is important.
And we'll take that up, the future of unions, and more on thoughts of Chuck and Aaron on unions. This is Dig Deep.